The Takeaway is supported by the Netflix original documentary Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. Following a high-stakes legal battle over a celebrity sex tape, this documentary explores the shadowed world of billionaires undermining democracy, now streaming only on Netflix.
This is The Takeaway, Friday, June 30th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening.
The first order of business is to repeal and replace Obamacare. And that was our message today, and it'll be our message on Capitol Hill. And it needs to be done.
There's Vice President Mike Pence before he was vice president, back in January, setting the Republican agenda, before he and his boss were even sworn in. Republicans have made repeal of the Affordable Care Act their number one mission, really, since the day it was enacted, back in 2010. That project moves along quickly now in legislative terms. The GOP House has done its work, and the GOP Senate is now busy. Republicans short of the votes for now, still behind the scenes trying to cut deals on taxes for the wealthy, on Medicaid for the poor, all to pass a version of repeal and replace. So far, more than 20 million Americans have gained insurance in Obamacare exchanges or through Medicaid expansions. Over the months, we've been hearing from many of you about your hopes and fears about what might happen to your coverage and your pocketbook if and when ACA goes away. A lot of you have reached out to us here on the show, and we want to bring back two listeners who've joined us before. Frazier Speaks and Kathy Ritterizer are back with questions about what these two competing bills might mean for them and their coverage. And Mary Agnes Carey is back as well. She's partnerships editor and senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She's here to help answer those questions. But first, there are a lot of moving parts in this Senate bill that's still subject to deals. So let's get a handle on where things stand right now.
Well, Mitch McConnell, who's the Senate Majority Leader, is working very, very hard to get 50 members of his caucus. Remember, there's only 52 Republicans in the Senate. He's trying to get 50 to be with him to at least get on their measure as it changes and get it on the floor and debate it. He's got a lot of moderates that are very concerned about the reductions in the Medicaid program that would happen over the next decade under the current Senate plan. There's concerns about whether or not the subsidies are generous enough. Conservatives feel that the current proposal isn't enough of an ACA repeal. That's another big problem. So he's got some horse trading. He's got some room to move. The Congressional Budget Office, as we like to call them, the CBO, the scorekeeper, came out earlier in the week and talked about how the Senate bill has an additional $200 billion in deficit reduction. The thought is that Mitch McConnell may use that money, for example, to give greater funding for treatment for opioid addiction. That's something that's been very important to Rob Portman, a senator from Ohio, and Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia. These are both Republicans. There may be some changes in some of the Medicaid funding. So he's working very hard, and this is kind of his specialty, listening to his members, finding out what they need, and delivering in a way to get people to yes.
And we're going to find out whether those skills that Mitch McConnell is so famous for can bring him over the line with a critical piece of the Republican agenda. But let's turn to some of our listeners now, because so many people watch this debate and it changes every day. They have a huge amount of uncertainty with something that's really, really important to them, their own health care and their own costs. Let's hear from Frazier Speaks now. She was on the program back in March, and she told us then that she has bipolar disorder and she's been hospitalized for it in the past.
I'm 27 years old, and I live in Charleston, South Carolina. My current health care situation is coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Personally, for me, I'm most worried about losing my coverage and my coverage for mental health services. As I understand, if this bill is passed, it's more up to the states if they want to cover mental health or disability instead of making it one of the things that has to be covered. How exactly detrimental will this be for people such as myself who struggle with mental health issues? I know that it's a possibility that it could be taken away, but I would like to know more about what are the exact things that will be taken away and how this will exactly affect people with mental health coverage.
Mary Agnes Carey, even before the ACA and then in the ACA, there were mandates, basically, that insurance companies had to cover mental health services like the ones that Frazier Speaks is concerned about. What's at stake here?
Well, you're exactly right. The essential health benefits is this package of 10 benefits that plans under the Affordable Care Act and also in the small group markets have to cover. They include things like maternity care or prescription drugs or mental health services. What would be allowed in the Senate bill if it stays the same way it is? And again, we're talking about the Senate Republican package. And this is also in the House passed package. We have to remember the House Republicans have done their own ACA reform, would allow states to get waivers from these essential health benefits to allow insurers in their state to offer coverage that is not as comprehensive. So, for example, if the state of South Carolina applied and received a waiver, they could allow insurers in their state to sell insurance packages that do not cover mental health services that Frazier needs. And so if that were to happen, the onus would be on the individual to make sure that they get a policy that covers what they need. And of course, more comprehensive coverage might be more expensive coverage.
All right, well, let's turn to another takeaway listener who's been on the show before. Kathy Ritterizer is 58 and lives on Long Island. She's desperate for Obamacare to go away. Her biggest problem, she says, is just cost.
I am currently getting my health insurance through United Healthcare Silver Plan, the exchange. You know, I'll just give you the numbers straight up. My income is between $40,000 and $48,000 a year here in New York. I pay a premium of $714 a month with no subsidies whatsoever. I have a copay each visit between $20 and $50, and I have a $2,500 deductible a year and a pre-existing condition. This is a very heavy burden because my health has to come first. However, it's anywhere from $10,000 to $12,000 a year out of what is considered here in New York a pretty minimal income, $40,000 to $48,000 a year. So it is a grave burden. My first question for any expert is, will there be, can there be caps placed on these insurance companies to give people like myself some type of comfort?
There's no guarantee in either the emerging Senate bill or the House passed bill. There's nothing that says an insurer would have caps on what they charge. The way to look at this is to think about, from the Republican standpoint, they want more of a free market system. They want fewer requirements on insurers. They want more variance in what's covered. We just talked about how plans under the Affordable Care Act have to cover this the 10 essential benefits. They don't want to necessarily make that a requirement. The hope is that if you add more freedom in the marketplace and take out federal regulation, that prices will drop, that consumers can go to coverage they need. Kathy may feel that her current Affordable Care Act plan is too generous, too comprehensive, it's too much, she doesn't need it. She'll have to look at the new marketplace, but there would be no restraints on how much an insurer could charge.
Kathy isn't getting any subsidies now, she says, and she's also concerned about whether she's going to get any help in the future.
Based on my current income and my age, can you tell me what my tax subsidies would be?
Now, under the emerging Senate Republican plan, and we've got to stress here that this is all fungible, that it could change right now. As I see it, Kathy wouldn't receive anything because her income is above 350% of poverty. So it looks like she would not get anything under the Senate bill. But in the House plan, because of her age, because she's 58, she would receive a $3,500 tax credit because of her age. And one thing we should throw out right now is in both the House passed plan and the emerging Senate plan, there's a variety of funds of money to be given to states to try to help people moderate their cost, help insurers with high-cost plans. So there may be relief in other avenues here. Even under the Senate plan, for example, she doesn't qualify for any kind of assistance. She went under the House, but there may be other methods of relief that she could get from her state.
Mary Agnes, there's one part of this debate that I really wanted to ask you about, and it's about costs. I've been listening to a lot of lawmakers go around and say they're not voting for anything unless it lowers insurance premiums. They're really focused on premiums. But premiums aren't the only game in town, right? Patients confront lots of different costs besides just premiums. Are they hiding the ball here?
Well, here's the thing. You're right. It's not just the premiums. It's your out-of-pocket costs. It's your deductibles. It's your co-pays. It's your co-insurance. It's how much does your insurance actually cover? For example, in the Senate plan now under debate, the plans would not have to cover as much to be as generous as those now in the Affordable Care Act. Under the Affordable Care Act, the mid-level plan covers about 70% of the costs. Under the Senate Republican plan now that's emerging, being developed, they'd have to cover about 58% of the costs. So the plans would not be as generous. In some cases, people who may have gotten a subsidy before in the Affordable Care Act wouldn't get one under the Senate plan. So it's not, to your point, it's not just the premium. It's all the copays, the deductibles, the total costs, and how generous that plan is. It's a really complicated mix.
Well, before we let you go, Mary Agnes Carey, let's talk politics for 1 second. This is Washington. Mitch McConnell is trying to get his deal. We already talked about that. If he doesn't get it, you know, people are already starting to whisper the B word in the Senate, bipartisan. It's a swear word these days, but there's increasing talk that McConnell may have to turn to some Democrats to come up with a health care plan that they can vote for, too. Is there any chance in this world that that happens?
It seems a little far-fetched right now, but you have to look at, to your point, at the bigger political calculation. Mitch McConnell and Republicans are extremely eager to get to tax reform. They think changing the marginal tax rates, lowering them, is going to help them in the midterms, perhaps in the next presidential. Senator McConnell has made it very clear, if I can't get a deal with my caucus, I'm going to have to go to Chuck Schumer, the minority leader, senator from New York. So as this story evolves, we'll be keeping our eye on that one for sure.
Turning to Chuck Schumer and the Democrats, it might be enough to scare any Senate Republican into making a deal with Mitch McConnell and President Trump and the House Republicans. Meanwhile, people's health care and their costs hang in the balance. And Mary Agnes Carey, I want to thank you for joining us to talk us through it.
Thanks for having me.
Mary Agnes Carey is partnerships editor and senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. And that was the scene in 1979 in Tehran, a student uprising backed by Muslim clerics and the Islamic Revolution in Iran. In the streets, throwing out American influence was one of the main planks of the Islamic Revolution. The slogans read, "America is Satan, down with the USA." Inside the U.S. embassy, Iranian students backed by the Ayatollah held more than 50 Americans hostage for over a year. That part of the story ended with the hostages' release after 444 days in captivity and hostile relations between the United States and Iran ever since. But there are new government documents now shedding more light than ever on how that story began, as far back as 1953.
In the quick shift of power, Mossadegh was finally apprehended and awaits trial for treason. The Shah, who had fled to Rome, comes home, backed by General Zahedi, military strongman, who engineered his return to power. Iranian oil may again flow westward.
That was a coup. The democratically elected prime minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, ousted from power. The Shah installed to power. Mossadegh's idea of nationalizing Iranian oil production destroyed. And behind it all, British intelligence operatives and the American CIA. Well, more than 1,000 pages of documents released just this month have filled in a lot of gaps of what we know about the U.S. role in that Iranian coup. Malcolm Byrne is director of research for the National Security Archive based at George Washington University in D.C., and he's worked for years to get documents like these released. He says the new material brings more detail and more nuance than ever to the story.
The material that had come out before was, you know, either leaked to the media or it was in the form of memoir accounts that are always kind of, you know, slightly sketchy in terms of possible bias. But now we've got a lot of different perspective and background and context to U.S. thinking and their fears and concerns and then their sort of the after effects and where do we go from here.
So, of course, we mentioned that Mossadegh was interested in nationalizing Iranian oil. The Americans and the Brits didn't like that. But also, this was 1953, the Soviets lurking in the background during the Cold War.
Absolutely. The Cold War is raging, and there are tremendous fears all around about what the Reds were up to. And when you look at these documents, you just see in almost every one, there's some alarming note about the Tudeh Party, which is the Communist Party in Iran. You could almost substitute ISIS or Al-Qaeda today and get the same kind of sense of alarm of, you know, what are they going to do next? Except add to that that this was the Soviet Union that had a whole lot of power and had atomic weapons and, you know, was believed to be ready to jump at the first chance.
And we should talk a little bit about the size of this operation. I mean, we're talking thousands of guns, lots of explosives, and millions of dollars through the CIA here.
It's a funny thing that it is millions of dollars ultimately, but that is part of the larger operation. What's surprising is how little it takes to, or at least it took back then, to pull something like this off. It was a matter of hooking up with like-minded, supportive people in key positions in Iran, getting them to gin up crowds to demonstrate and show support for the Shah. And that's how they pulled it off. It really was kind of cheap.
Kind of cheap in cash terms, Malcolm Byrne, but we have the benefit of hindsight now. And we started this segment with sound from the streets of Tehran in 1979, which is really where, to a lot of people, this chapter actually ends. Was there any indication in 1953, even with the president, the director of the CIA in these documents, that what they were doing could ultimately lead to enormous backlash against American interests in Iran?
There is nothing in these documents that we're seeing now that shows that. It's all the other direction. It's all, oh my God, here, you know, the Tudeh is ready to jump. No matter what the development is that you're reading about, whether it's the assassination of the prime minister that came before Mossadegh or some other development, it always is turned to explaining how this makes the situation worse and that we really need to act now. And I've done interviews, and other scholars have done interviews with former participants and former CIA guys, and their sense is that, look, we had an emergency that we had to deal with. We did the job. It was up to the politicians and our subsequent presidents to work with the Shah to get him to abide by the reforms he had promised and so on. So that is something that they... There's a total disconnect, I think, in the minds of U.S. officials at the time.
Well, talk about your quest to get these documents released, because the Obama administration did not let these documents out. They were involved in talks with Iran, as we know. Now, in the Trump administration, only a few months old, they've poured out into the public.
Right. It's very interesting to see this process unfold. The story goes back to 1989, just as the Cold War is winding down, when a volume like this was supposed to come out, and it did come out, except it left out any sense at all that the U.S. and the British were involved in this coup. They made it sound like a spontaneous, popular demonstration that carried the Shah back to power. And it caused a huge scandal. The head of the advisory committee for the State Department that oversees this series resigned in protest. Congress got involved. They passed new legislation that required a thorough and accurate account of our history. And the State Department promised that they would try again. And that took years. But then, as you say, the Obama administration and the Kerry State Department had just wrapped up this landmark nuclear deal, and it's a very important agreement. And it's got powerful enemies on both sides, in both countries, on the right wing. And the State Department under Kerry was very worried that any kind of excuse could be used by hardliners in Tehran to say, look at what a bad partner the Americans are. Look at how interventionist they are. We've got to scratch this deal. It's bad for us. That was what they were worried about.
So this story is being told now, Malcolm Byrne, thanks to your efforts and the efforts of other historians. What is this story to you? Is it one of real politic and just the way the world was in the Cold War? Is it American hubris? What is it?
Well, first of all, I want to give credit to people inside the State Department, and believe it or not, even inside the CIA, who were interested in seeing this story come out. It's not a monolithic entity that we're dealing with here. So a lot of effort went into this all around. But it's incredibly important, and I think those folks agree with those of us on the outside that this is a story about a chapter of U.S. history that shows us not at our best. But it also shows us as fallible humans and policymakers who tend to see the worst case scenario, tend to worry about what the absolute worst thing is that could happen to us. And that spawns not necessarily well thought through actions. And I think we face that danger all the time. We face it today. We faced it in 9/11. The tendency to overreact, to become alarmist, and to take steps that might not necessarily be in our best interest, and we don't see that until the dust settles. So this is it's a cautionary tale about what can happen.
Malcolm Byrne, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Todd.
Malcolm Byrne is Director of Research for the National Security Archive, based at George Washington University. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Back in July of 2015, Jim Steinle testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Unfortunately, due to disjointed laws and basic incompetence on many levels, the U.S. has suffered a self-inflicted wound in the murder of our daughter by the hand of a person that should have never been on the streets of this country. I say this because the alleged murderer is an undocumented immigrant who has been convicted of 7 felonies in the U.S. and already deported 5 times. Yet in March of this year, he was released from jail and allowed to stay here freely because of those legal loopholes.
The 2015 murder of Jim Steinle's daughter, Catherine, by an immigrant in the U.S. illegally, served as a catalyst for what would become known as Cates Law, legislation imposing tougher penalties on deportees who re-enter the United States. The stories of family members with loved ones who were the victims of violence perpetrated by illegal immigrants became a key feature of President Trump's campaign. Cates Steinle's story was featured at the Republican National Convention in July, along with other similar stories. Family members who spoke under a banner that read, Victims of Illegal Immigration. Now, on Thursday, the House voted to pass Cates Law and the No Sanctuary for Criminals Act, which cracks down on so-called sanctuary cities. But behind these individual tragedies, there's data to suggest that immigrants in the country illegally don't commit crimes any more than American citizens do. Tom Holman, the acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, acknowledged as much in an off-camera briefing at the White House this week. Randy Capps is director of research of U.S. programs at the Migration Policy Institute. Randy, welcome.
Hello, and thank you for having me on your program.
And let's drill down on Cates Law for a moment. What exactly does it do?
It increases the penalties in terms of federal prison time for people who re-enter the country illegally.
So people who are scooped up here, deported, and then they come back, in other words.
That's correct. And they get essentially up to 2 years of prison time if they re-enter illegally, regardless of whether or not they have committed any other crime. And they get a lot more time than that, starting at 10 years, if they've committed a felony or a series of misdemeanors additionally.
Is there evidence that what Cates Law does through legislation would help prevent the kind of tragedies that his family faced when his daughter was murdered?
Well, it's hard to say because in that particular case, you know, the murderer was released wrongly from federal prison, and snafus like that can always happen. I think what this bill does more broadly is to just increase the federal prison time as a disincentive for anyone who's been in the country without authorization to try to enter again illegally.
Well, part of that question then is what were deportation policies before this? Somebody like Cates' assailant or similar people presumably were subject to deportation before.
He was. He would have been a very high priority under the Obama administration because of the multiple felonies that he had. And again, the situation is that he happened to slip through the cracks. I don't think there's any disagreement between the political parties or among people on either side of the immigration issue that someone like him should have been deported and not allowed to come back.
Let's talk about the data that I mentioned a little bit, whether or not illegal immigrants in the United States are more likely to commit violent crime. What do we know?
Well, we know that their incarceration rate is lower. We don't know a whole lot more than that because it's very hard to survey people on criminal behavior and also very hard to get at their immigration status in those surveys. But there's certainly no hard evidence to suggest they're any more likely to commit serious crimes than anyone else.
In terms of policy, do you see this as an area of immigration law or one of preventing murders, like the police?
Law enforcement officials have come down on both sides of this. Some law enforcement officials, some police chiefs and sheriffs have said that if you're going to put everyone in the unauthorized population at risk of deportation, then immigrants are not going to cooperate with their investigations, and that puts more people at risk. And then there are other law enforcement officials that say, because somebody's here in the first place without authorization, that they've already committed a crime and that somehow makes them more prone to commit other crimes. Also, there's a theory of policing that people who commit minor violations may later on commit more serious violations. And so I just think there's a lot of disagreement in the law enforcement community over what the right approach is.
These two bills passed by the House, Cates Law and the No Sanctuary for Criminals Act, really two small parts of a much, much larger debate over immigration and immigration reform in this country. How do they fit into the larger debate, and are they likely to become law on their own?
it doesn't seem that the Senate would pass these bills because the Senate already rejected Kate's law. And yesterday, the House vote was more strongly in favor of Kate's law than the anti-sanctuary bill. But I would say the anti-sanctuary bill is a bigger change from current policy. Right now, there are cities and states that don't place detainers. They don't hold people for extra time because the federal immigration authorities want to deport them. And in some cases, they don't share information about them. And this anti-sanctuary bill would have a lot more teeth. And I think, you know, that would change a situation for immigrant communities in several major cities like New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles considerably if it passed.
Randy Capps, Director of Research for U.S. Programs at the Migration Policy Institute. Thanks, Randy.
Thank you so much.
The Takeaway is supported by Netflix, presenting the original documentary Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. When a celebrity sex tape is leaked, a high-stakes legal battle between Gawker and former professional wrestler Hulk Hogan leads to the gossip site's ruin. Nobody Speak explores the shadowed world of billionaires manipulating free speech, ultimately revealing what power and money can do in undermining democracy. Now streaming only on Netflix.
The way I see it, you and me got one thing to talk about, and that's what you are willing to do for me.
You should reward me accordingly.
Which bothers some men. The word itself makes some men uncomfortable.
I volunteer as tribute.
You're going to find out that we're wanted in two states and probably considered armed and dangerous.
Friday, of course, is movie time here on The Takeaway, and that means, as always, we have our resident movie critic, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, with me in studio. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
It's great to have you. We've got two films today that we're going to be talking about. Baby Driver, director Edgar Wright has that new one, and also the little lovable yellow capsule Minions of Despicable Me 3 are coming, so we'll be talking about that. Let's get to some trivia first. In a couple of minutes, we're going to be talking about the classic, now 1991, Thelma and Louise. Directed by Ridley Scott. A lot of people don't know that. That was too easy. But here's your trivia question for Thelma and Louise, which is coming up just in a couple of minutes here on the show. Of course, everybody remembers Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis, Thelma and Louise, in that big picture. Here's your trivia question, though. What two Hollywood stars were originally envisioned for the roles of Thelma and Louise and indeed wanted the part, but it never worked out? They're huge stars. You'll know the name when you hear them, so think about that. Don't answer now. Hey, if you know it on Twitter, what two Hollywood stars were originally supposed to be Thelma and Louise? Hit me on Twitter, at Todd Zwillick. See if you know it. All right, Rafer, let's go to Baby Driver. I mentioned this was Edgar Wright directing. Ansel Elgort is the Baby Driver, a young getaway driver who finds himself taking part in some crimes he didn't expect.
So you're just starting your day, or did you just get off?
Oh, I don't know if I ever get off. They call, I go, you know.
So what is it you do?
I'm a driver.
Oh, like a chauffeur. You drive around important people.
I guess I do.
Anyone I'd know?
I hope not.
Well, he's like a chauffeur, but not really. This has John Hamm, Jamie Foxx in it as well.
That's right. Excellent cast. Kevin Spacey as well, who plays the crime kingpin. The hook here is really that this young driver, played by Ansel Elgort, is like a teenager, and he has to have music, earbuds in his ears to drown out the tinnitus that was caused by a childhood trauma. And so that's kind of the hook here. And what that gives you is an excuse to have this fantastic rock soundtrack with, you know, John Spencer Blues Explosion and Queen and the Commodores and the Damned playing throughout this entire film. You know, if Edgar Wright, who did Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, Hot Fuzz, Shaun of the Dead, if he weren't the guy doing this movie, it wouldn't work. But this is so much fun. It's so funny, so inventive, a little contrived, a strange premise that doesn't always work at every minute of the film. But for the most part, it's got such a wild energy and so much humor and such a great cast that it really works.
Well, we know Ansel Elgort from A Fault in Our Stars, right?
That's right, yes.
But the promo I saw online for this movie, Rafer, focused entirely on the soundtrack.
And it's just, it works like a charm when it's really like firing on all cylinders. It's a lot of fun, great car chase scenes. I was really, really pleased. And it's a very fresh, I think, and kind of different movie for this summer that doesn't feel feel quite like anything else that's out right now.
And just to make sure, worth seeing in the theater, because a great soundtrack means I can download that too and just listen to it on my own time.
Completely, and it's completely a big screen film. I mean, if you're a Smoking the Bandit fan, if you love any kind of car chase, you know, Eat My Dust, Gone in 60 Seconds, vintage car chase movies, you're going to love this film.
That's Baby Driver. Come for the soundtrack, stay for the rest of the movie, says Rafer Guzman. Despicable Me, everybody knows the Minions. I describe them as little yellow capsules, which is what they look like to me. They're cute. Of course, Steve Carell is in on this one. Trey Parker and Kristen Wiig. Let's listen.
Hello, Gru. How's your transition coming? You know, from world's worst villain to world's worst agent?
Oh, that's hilarious. You should be on TV.
Ah!
Oh, that's right. You were. But then you got canceled.
Part of that clip sounds like South Park, and there's a reason why. That's Trey Parker.
Of course, that's right. He's playing a villain here named Balthazar Bratt. He was a child actor during the 80s, and of course, he's still clinging to that decade. So it's a lot of jokes about Rubik's Cubes and shoulder pads. But this is good for the parents. Again, soundtrack-wise, Nana, Aha, Phil Collins, Dire Straits. That's to keep the parents happy. Me, I've kind of given up disliking these films in any active way. I just kind of go with them now that they've come around.
They wore you down.
They really did. This is where, you know, it's called Despicable Me 3, but of course we're four films in if you count the Minions spinoff. So by this point, they're unobjectionable, harmless, junky fun. Kids love them. My kids love them. You know, I'll make my wife see this one with the kids since I've already seen it. But, you know, Steve Carell's very good. Kristen Wiig's very good. It's a good cast, and there are some funny moments.
That's the fourth iteration of Despicable Me, even though it's called Despicable Me 3. Before we let you go, let's get back to trivia now. We're going to be talking about Thelma and Louise and the story behind the making of that film in just a minute, directed by Ridley Scott, as I said. Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon, Thelma and Louise, as we said, but two other famous Hollywood stars, Rafer, were first envisioned to be in this film, and they wanted to be. They didn't wind up in the movie. Who are they?
You stumped me, but I'm going to do the SAT trick where I just throw out a guess because it's better than nothing. Julia Roberts and Nicole Kidman.
That's a little game theory. Excellent guesses, but both wrong. How about Jodie Foster and Michelle Pfeiffer?
Ah.
Originally had the first look at Thelma and Louise, and neither one of them wound up in the film. And we're going to be talking about that and more with the making of Thelma and Louise in just a minute. In the meantime, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and for us here at The Takeaway. Thanks.
Thanks, Todd.
Okay, then, listen. Let's not get caught. What are you talking about? Let's keep going. What do you mean? Go!
You probably already know who you're listening to there, Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis. And you probably know the film, too. Thelma and Louise getting ready to gun the engine and drive their Thunderbird convertible over a cliff and into the Grand Canyon. It's one of the most recognized movies in America. It's the story of two women running away from the law and from their own lives. It was a movie that had trouble getting made and then, following its release in 1991, became a huge hit.
I think the movie had such a profound effect on people because they were seeing real women, and these women were coping with the kinds of issues that so frustrate women in normal life.
That's author Becky Aikman there. She says Thelma and Louise was a rare, almost unheard-of film, fantasy and escapism based on the ordinary lives of two ordinary women. Making the film was improbable, too. A young female novice screenwriter and two women in the lead roles. Aikman has a new book. It's called Off the Cliff, How the Making of Thelma and Louise Drove Hollywood to the Edge. The screenwriter was Callie Curry. And Aikman says Curry envisioned a film that was ultimately about women escaping the bounds of society. That final classic scene, the convertible flying over the cliff, it wasn't about death. It was about flight.
That's how Callie saw that ending. She didn't see it as depressing. She saw it as a break for freedom.
And talking about that ending, by the way, she said they had to leave at the end of the film, right? It wasn't a death, she said. It wasn't a suicide. I think she said it was flight. It was freedom.
Yes, that's how she saw it. And the director, Ridley Scott, saw it as Thelma and Louise entering into the realm of myth. It's why he set that scene in such a grand, majestic setting so that it would have that sense for the audience.
Well, let's talk about Callie Curry for a minute, because this was an improbable film. She was an improbable screenwriter in the sense that she'd never done one before, and she was kind of working on some pretty seedy fringes of the film industry at the time.
That's true. It's such a lesson about how an outlier can come in and make a very original statement. Callie was 30 years old when she wrote this. She was a college dropout and former waitress, and her job at that time was working behind the scenes on really cheesy music videos. She was working in a very sexist industry, Hollywood, but at the lowest possible end of it, where she had to help hire strippers to dance in the background of music videos from second-rate bands.
We're talking like Whitesnake and, sorry, Whitesnake fans, but we're talking like rock videos and...
Right, yes. A lot of videos of guys in spandex with big hair and women shaking their booty.
And somehow she comes to the place where she's putting together this story that becomes Thelma and Louise on her own or late at night.
That's right. And Thelma and Louise are the characters are based on Callie and her close friend, Pam Tillis. One of them is the more flighty one of them is the more sensible one, but they often switch roles, as the two characters do in the movie.
Well, you mentioned Ridley Scott, who is another improbable part of this film. He was reluctant at first to get involved. He was already a legend. People hear Ridley Scott and they think, of course, Alien. They think Blade Runner. That's the Ridley Scott that we all know. We're not thinking of renegade women pushing back and freeing themselves from authority necessarily. He didn't want to be involved in this thing when he first read it.
That's for sure. When he first read it, Ridley was also somewhat of an outlier. He worked mostly in England, and he wasn't that aware that women's films were considered box office cyanide by Hollywood. He read the script and he thought it was wonderfully written. And first he wanted to produce. As he shopped it around to various other directors who didn't see it the way he did, he became convinced that he should direct. And that's another key moment when things went right that could have gone wrong, because Ridley recognized what he didn't know. He realized he didn't understand this women's film. He didn't understand these characters. So he spent a lot of time with Callie Curry going through the script and subsuming his point of view to hers. For example, she explained to him that women really do have to listen to catcalls from people like the truck driver. Ridley expressed skepticism to me that that really happened, but he decided if this is the way Callie wrote it, this is the way he's filming it. So he wound up making a picture from a woman's point of view, even though, as you say, from his other films, it's not the kind of thing he usually does.
What was different about this project getting done that's different from thousands of other movies that get made and churned and make money or don't and on to the next?
Right. Well, as we know today, and it was the same back then, Hollywood was very reluctant to make movies that were directed by women, written by women, that had women as the leading characters. When this script was shopped around Hollywood, people were very open about saying, we can't make this, there are two women in the leads. Callie Curry was told by many people that the script was great, but that she needed to tone it down. The women weren't likable. The audience wouldn't stand for it if women committed violence. She was told that she should have a man rescue them at the end. When the script was sent out for studios to bid on, they all said no, except for one, a very small, financially troubled studio called Pathé Entertainment. It was the only one willing to take a risk on a movie like this.
Talk about taking risks. We talked a moment ago in our movie segment about a little bit of trivia for this movie that Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon did not have the first look at this script. In fact, it was Jodie Foster and Michelle Pfeiffer. How is it that they did not wind up being in this blockbuster hit?
There were so many delays while Ridley was trying to line up a studio willing to pay for it, while he was trying to find a director. They had to move on to other projects. And at that point, every female actress in Hollywood wanted one of these two roles, because a role like this is so hard to come by. So virtually any name from that era was considered for the parts. When Ridley Scott chose Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon, he did it over the studio's objections, because they wanted bigger box office stars. They liked the idea of Cher. They liked the idea of Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn. But Ridley doesn't care about big name stars. He wanted the people he saw as being right for the part.
Why was it such a hit? What did it do for people that they hadn't seen before or that really got inside of them, do you think?
It came straight from the heart of Callie Khouri. It was completely from a woman's point of view. The action in the movie arises from all the kinds of things that drive women crazy in their real lives. And women got to see somebody rebel against that, got to see themselves on the screen. That is very rare. As the marketing department for Thelma and Louise was always worried, they said, we know we could possibly sell a woman's movie, but the woman has to be bimbo-ish. That's the only way we know how to sell it. So that's what most of us are accustomed to seeing on screen. People went crazy because they saw somebody they thought seemed real.
I mean, it's the movies. You can't go around blowing up trucks when people make you mad. You can't go around shooting people. But they did in this movie, and you write, and I think you're quoting Callie Khouri here, you can write a true story that never happened.
Right. Of course, it's bigger than life. Of course, when some guy makes a catcall to me on the street, I would like to blow up his truck. But I don't. It's a lot of fun to see it on the screen, though. There's a truth at the center of it.
The book is Off the Cliff, How the Making of Thelma and Louise Drove Hollywood to the Edge. Becky Aikman is the author. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
What's your most memorable road trip?
Hi, I'm Vicky from the San Francisco Bay Area. The man who became my second husband flew to Miami, where I lived, to travel with me cross-country to join him in San Francisco, where I had a job waiting. We were flying down the road in the middle of Texas when I got pulled over by a highway patrolman. "Ma'am, what car are you doing? 85, she said. "Do you have any guns or contraband?" We didn't, but we did have open containers of margaritas, and the car reeked of tequila. I think we dodged a big bullet on that. I was 29. That was my first speeding ticket, and it was payable to Judge Freddie Capers. The marriage didn't last, but we sure had fun on that trip.
Hi, this is Megan from Denton, Texas. Just wanted to share a little road trip I took a few years ago with just myself and my little dog, Twig. We left Denton and drove a week through New Mexico, hitting up their state parks. We saw volcanoes in Capulin and slept in my car in Eagles Nest Lake and went camping and swimming at Elephant Butte State Park and ate SpaghettiOs from a can watching the sunset at White Sands National Monument. I don't have him anymore. He died earlier this year, so it's kind of my greatest memory I could ever have.
One road trip with the dog, another with the ex. Tell us your road trip stories, good or bad, 8778-MY-TAKE. You can join the conversation on our Facebook page. Have a great weekend if your holiday starts early. Thanks for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. We'll see you on Monday. This is The Takeaway.